This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for tuning in to the French Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm Annie Desasore, and today it is my great pleasure to speak with Dr. Brett Brehm about his first book, Clidophonic Modernity, Transatlantic Sound, Technology, and Literature, published at Fordham University Press in 2023. Hi, Brett. Welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Annie. Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here, really. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you. To start us off, I'd just like to give you a chance to tell listeners a little bit about yourself and your background, anything you'd like to share, and perhaps what led you to study French literature and French studies.
Sure. Be my pleasure. I come from a background in music, actually. So that was one thing that led me to this particular topic. And I guess we were just talking a little bit about Paris before we started this interview, but led me to spend some time in Paris playing in some jazz clubs. I played piano since I was, I think, maybe 9 or 10 years old, and still continue to play, not as much as I would like, but I really, really enjoy it when I can. And the times when I find a chance to sit in on a jazz jam session in Paris, it's really a true pleasure. So that's something that I think is animated my research, my studies in French. I'm really interested in sort of the connections, musical connections between the U.S. and France. Haven't published yet on that, and it's sort of the history of jazz between France and the U.S., but something I might be interested in doing down the line. But my experience with French studies started in high school. Had some really, really wonderful teachers in high school. Then in college as well, I continued studying French and had the opportunity to teach English, actually. In fact, in Paris, or just outside Paris, the year after I graduated from undergrad. So I said to myself, I don't want to lose this connection. I don't want to lose the connection with the language, with the city, with the culture, you know, music, the literature, philosophy, everything. So I started studying more literature, more actually some art history for a while, and here I am.
Yeah, no, you mentioned, I mean, I was going to ask kind of the origins of this particular project, and you mentioned music, but you're also evoking literature and art history. I mean, all this is coming out in, all these are important things that you study in your book, of course. So would you say that the kind of getting to the origin of this project, it's an interest in music, but kind of intellectually, did it originate with one author in particular? You talk about Charles Cros, Baudelaire, Whitman, Poe, Nina de Villard, but also, as we'll discuss, the kind of history, early history or prehistory of technological developments in audiovisual reproduction. So how did this kind of all come together as you were conceiving of the book in its early stages?
Right. I think in terms of a single author, I mean, I studied comparative literature for my doctorate, and many of our courses included readings from Walter Benjamin. So I believe it was potentially an essay that I wrote on Benjamin and the idea of acoustics and sound, and if we could think about some of Benjamin's ideas from a sort of an acoustical perspective. And the professor said, you know, this is a really intriguing angle, because there's certainly so many things that can be said about visual culture, visual studies, but at this point, the acoustic really remains wide open in ways. So it's sort of, I think, I mean, I was coming at that initial turn to the acoustic from music. So I was still playing a lot of music at that time, a lot of piano, and thinking about music in relation to painting and literature. And so I think it was that desire to sort of bridge, you know, different disciplines, different art forms together. That led me to think about, well, okay, you know, could we think about some of Benjamin's ideas from an acoustical standpoint? And from there, I discovered various other authors, and it was thanks to another professor of mine in graduate school that I discovered Charles Cros. That's C-R-O-S. Some people mistakenly hear Cheryl Crow, and very different story. If I was, but maybe
that could be interesting. That would be a different book, but yeah.
You know, American pronouncing Charles Cros, you know, or Charles Cros. I've even heard different pronunciations in parts of France and the southern regions. There's a Cros, I think.
Cros, yeah. I wondered if the S was silent or not.
So it was the suggestion of one of my dissertation, you know, committee members that, you know, well, who's this, you know, maybe we, you know, look at this guy, Charles Cros, and see if there's something there, because he had heard, you know, by, you know, just his reputation that he was involved with the invention of the phonograph, or sort of a almost invention. His own paleophone was a dreamed of device that he, we think, never actually got to build, or at least there's no evidence that he actually built the machine. But interestingly, I looked at him initially and discovered some stories that, okay, yes, this definitely touches on audiovisual machines and acoustics, and there's certainly some things I can say, but I didn't know how far it could take me. I didn't know if I would devote, you know, even an entire chapter to him, and he's turned out to be the first chapter of the book. And I think it was the turn to some of his scientific papers and to looking at his poetry in different ways that I discovered, oh, wait a minute, there is a whole, you know, field of possibilities here for thinking about his writings from this kind of angle. And I discovered, wow, there's actually a whole lot that I could say, certainly a chapter, if not an entire book. So that was I'd have to say, one of the real thrilling moments of the research for me was when I sort of came to that realization that there's so much in the material there, and not just, you know, one particular story where he'll explicitly reference the phonograph or, you know, sound recording, but so many other elements. So, those are sort of some of the origins of the project. I had something of a blueprint, and he was in there in the beginning, and then it expanded. Poe was not in there in the beginning for. I have posed my second chapter. So for the transatlantic angle, that was something, you know, interesting in terms of how research can proceed. You know, you start off with an idea of a shape of the book, a shape of your research, and you discover other authors and other connections. And so I often tell my students, you know, it's good to have a blueprint to start with, or some idea, but just go into it knowing that, you know, things can change and you're going to be open to those possibilities. So I was glad that I was open to those possibilities, and that Poe found his way into the book, because I enjoyed writing that chapter.
Yeah, me too. And I enjoyed reading it as someone who loved reading Poe, you know, in high school, and just, you know, seeing and thinking about it kind of challenged my way of thinking about him, realizing, right, sound is everywhere in this. So I really like how you brought that out. But I wanted to return briefly to, you were talking about Cros and his almost invention, or, you know, his idea of the invention of the paleophone. And you also talk in the beginning of your introduction about the French inventor Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville, who invented an early recording device, the phonautograph, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, before almost two decades before Thomas Edison invented the phonograph. So these are just two examples of the many kind of earlier proto technologies that you mentioned throughout your book. And I learned all kinds of new things. There's a lot more of these technologies than I realized after having read your book. So I'm wondering if you could talk about kind of your choice to focus on these, one could call them failed technologies that have been bought out by more successful technologies. But really, you talk about proto technologies and thinking about how studying them helped you think about how people were thinking about sound in different ways, or kind of why did you choose to kind of focus on these technologies in your book or as a frame?
Right. The prehistory, we could say. I think, immediately off the bat, I think that a lot of the scholarship tended to look at the moment of invention and the decades immediately following, which is certainly of vital importance for the history. So we're talking about the 19th century saw the invention of photography, saw the invention of mechanical sound recording. You could call it phonography. Phonograph was the first term widely used to describe this phenomenon. We saw the invention of the telephone just roughly a year before the phonograph, and cinema. Towards the end of the century, roughly 1895, with the Lumiere brothers. So all these inventions, there's certainly sea shifts in the landscape of media technologies of the era. But I got at some point very interested in thinking about, well, what led up to these moments? What's the prehistory? And there certainly has been important and vital work done in that area. A touchstone for a lot of sound studies scholars is Jonathan Stern's The Audible Past. And that was certainly an inspiration for me. I decided I wanted to look more closely at the literary prehistory. Certainly also the science side of things, but where they intersected. That was really important for me. What did people think these inventions could do, and how were they used as touchstones? So earlier inventions used as touchstones for later ones. That got me to thinking about, again, Charles Cros, who worked not only on sound recording, but also on color photography. I'm happy that I was able to get at least, I think, one if not two of his early experiments in color photography in my book. Worked really hard for those illustrations.
Yeah, I imagined, because they were, for a book about sound, but of course it's not just about sound, but there's so many striking visuals, like the illustrations, and also from not just that time period, the 19th century, but more modern works as well. It's really, yeah, there's a lot of beautiful visuals.
Thank you. Yeah. I enjoy them, flipping through and, still think there's more I'd like to write about these visuals in ways. But getting back to the question of why the prehistory, another touchstone throughout the book that speaks to both the visual and the acoustic side is the example of the acoustic daguerreotype. And this was a phrase that came from a famous, I guess you call him a giant of 19th century photography, Félix Nadar. And he speculated that, in the future there could be something like an acoustic daguerreotype. We could do for sound what we've done with light and photography. And I believe as well the device that you mentioned, Edward Leon Scott de Martinville, his phonautograph, he uses a similar analogy when he's describing his device. So that was both a touchstone for me throughout the book in thinking about how the acoustic and the visual interact, and also something that I wanted to learn more about. So I had to go digging through Nadar's writings, because it was not easy to find the two references. There was a small error in one of the citations that I had about it. So I really had to go digging for, in different, publications until I could find specifically what he was saying. So no, I didn't want to get it secondhand. I knew if that was an important idea for me, I had to go to the source. I guess also coming back to the origins of the project, I guess when I started graduate school, like it was 2007, 2008, I think it was the spring of that year when there was this discovery that researchers could make some of these recordings that Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville had made in the 1850s, late 1850s, early 1860s, make them sound again, make them audible. Previously, no one had heard back that far in time. It was a group, I think it was led by Patrick Feaster, who was one of the researchers, a number of other physicists and researchers working in this area of what some people have called archaeophony, or a certain archaeology of sound. So that was certainly in the sort of constellation of elements that was inspiring me, getting me to think about moments other than the sort of eureka or aha moments of invention. You know, what were the devices that led up to these moments? And maybe we don't want to call them dead ends, but the movements or the devices that had a certain purpose but didn't quite win out over the others. So I talk about it in my conclusion, but it's an effort to think about these historical moments not entirely dominated by one medium or one essential technology. So are we moving into the age of artificial intelligence now? Is this the AI moment? You know, what will people think 20 years from now about this moment that we're moving into? And we talk about the age of Edison, the electric light bulb, age of the phonograph, information age, all of these ages. I think it's helpful to use those terms, but also we need to be critical of them and think, you know, what other forces were at play, what other imaginaries, and for me, importantly, where did literature, where did the visual arts, where did music, where did all those discourses enter into connection with these discoveries, these inventions?
Right, exactly. No, I thought it was a really fascinating way to approach these questions, because you're not, you know, it's not a project that's looking at, oh, let's look at the influence of this new technology on how people are writing, or, you know, drawing a direct connection point A to point B. It's really, you point really to more about how authors are envisioning, imagining possibilities, thinking about sound in new ways, that are anticipating these technologies, or that are engaging with the implications of these technologies for human consciousness, and a lot of really deep questions that these authors are grappling with already. So I really appreciated that approach. It was very fascinating to read. And in going back to that that question of what these technologies or how they're being imagined and how their uses might be imagined, and you mentioned, with the Scott de Martinville, the kind of using technology to go back and to make something sound that had been previously, had never been heard before, which is, you know, and you reference in your book that firstsounds.org, I think is, or .com is the website where you can listen to it.
Some of these samples, you know, of, it's just, they're mind-boggling. It's just extraordinary to listen back that far. Firstsounds.org, you can listen to a lot of these earliest of recordings. Yeah. But so
I went, and you know, as I was reading, I went and listened, and it was, to be honest, very kind of unsettling, like very eerie and creepy almost. And this is something that comes up in your book, how authors are thinking about sound in these ways, kind of communicating with, you know, you mentioned Jonathan Stern in The Audible Pass, and he makes this case that the invention of the phonograph was linked to this Victoria era obsession with death and culture of death, and that sound reproduction technology was a way to preserve and listen to the voices of the dead. And so I'm wondering how, you know, in your book, as you're you know, you mentioned Poe. I mean, there's a lot to say there, I think, but with other authors as well, how are they making connections between sound reproduction or imagining the possibilities of sound reproduction, preservation, and then communicating with voices from beyond, whether from the past or, you know, even with Coe, he's imagining interstellar communication in a futuristic setting. So yeah, how are authors, I guess, thinking about kind of the unsettling, kind of eerie aspects of sound, or it, if you would say that they are conceiving them of them in these ways?
Sure, sure. I think certainly the unsettling would describe it well. With Poe, I would say unnerving. There was a certain language and literary language of nerves as sort of these organic networks, and how sound and recorded sound could be threatening or kind of shock. We think about Walter Benjamin again, thinking about urban life and the urban shock in the 19th century. But to think about just how unsettling, how unnerving, you know, it is for our experience to listen back that far in time, like as if we shouldn't be able to, as if, you know, just like, no, like that's a silent era. Think about a silent era of film, silent era of history. And no, we shouldn't be able to listen back that far in time. And at the same time for writers and artists, you know, photographers like Nadar back then, thinking about what would that experience be like in the future? Would it be marvelous or would it be scary? And there was a very real fear of photography back at the time. And this very famous story of that, again, Nadar relates of Balzac and the theory of specters. And then the idea that every time you were photographed, it would take away a thin layer of your body. There's a story I write about in the introduction of the book about, you know, this taken to a kind of literal extreme where the sitter is obliterated, his body is obliterated, but his voice remains. So there is a kind of horror to that. The story itself is mostly comical. I think I write it as, you know, it's really a charming story, but there's a fear animating it. There's a horror to thinking about voices that persist, like the listening to the dead, preserving the dead in their, with their voices in a way. At the same time, I was aware of that going into the project and the research, and I thought, okay, I want to get, you know, deeper into that. And with Poe, I certainly found that was a critical element, that he was thinking about acoustics, recording as a kind of unnerving area, something that was related to death and the macabre, as we would expect with Poe. And then I got to Crowe, the French inventor of sound recording, or French almost inventor, and he had some different takes on it. I mean, he thought about you know, preserving beloved voices. So in one of his poems, Inscription, it's sort of an homage to his various inventions. He thinks about preserving beloved voices for the future, stopping time in a way. So it wasn't so much for him, not always a fascination with death, but thinking about love, memory. There's another story I write about where you mentioned the interstellar side, and these Crowe is just wonderful and wild in so many ways. I mean, he dreamed about, you know, interplanetary, you know, communication. There's an article about, you know, his attempt to maybe speak Martian or develop an interplanetary language. It almost sounds like something like digital code, ones and zeros or something. He's got these immense mirrors. But in this very, you know, science fiction type short story, he talks about communication with Venus and a scientist on Venus, and, you know, what these communications would be, the sound recordings would be like. And it was sort of sound recording in the spirit of scientific research and, you know, romantic encounters and sort of communication at a distance that, you know, we're all so accustomed to today, that's, you know, totally mundane, but then was dreamed of as a kind of magical thing. The last thing I might say on that is when I finally got to Nadar's, I think it was his first writing about the idea of the acoustic daguerreotype. He also had a very interesting political perspective on it, thinking about, okay, the newspapers are so biased, we're getting things secondhand. Wouldn't it be remarkable if we could have an audio transcript of, you know, parliamentary debate, of, you know, this political debate that we're getting secondhand? And it was a kind of dream of objectivity in some way. So I certainly think the fascination with death and hearing voices of the dead, you know, resonated throughout the century and throughout a lot of these writers. But there were certainly other frames of reference, other lenses that writers at the time put on it, and I was thrilled and, you know, fascinated to discover these lenses, that it was death and other ways.
Yeah, no, it's interesting what you say about Nadar and this kind of dream of objectivity that you say that you know. So interesting for us to talk about this today, where we can have recordings, right, of absolutely everything, and yet it seems like the truth is even harder to establish, perhaps. Right. And, you know, of course, AI is a whole nother question that gets roped in there. But you were saying how authors have different lenses to understand and interpret these technologies or imagine their possibilities. And Baudelaire is one of your main interlocutors, and he it seems that he is one of the figures in your book that is really, I mean, interested in these questions of sound, intrigued by these questions of possible sound reproduction, but also very skeptical of them. And he was famously very skeptical and critical of photography. And though he seems to be more interested in the possibility of that, you talk about the pre-cinematic or the proto phonographic lens that Baudelaire kind of explores. So could you maybe unpack how different authors have different perspectives on this idea of how these technological advancements are leading to some kind of progress, and perhaps how their work is imagining a dark side of technology or articulating anxieties around these technologies?
Right. Certainly anxieties, certainly on the part of Baudelaire. And he was, has been known for a while, skeptical, would put it, you know, mildly, about photography. And sort of, I think the way I might have put it was a sort of infringement on the domain of high art, that it would take over in a way. And it was too much precision. It was too much, you know, in a way, maybe objectivity, that photography of the day didn't have the kind of artistry that you might find with a drawing or a print. And it was kind of a little nasty of him to be doing this, even as he's good friends with Nadar. So that anxiety that I guess it would take over, that the public was, and I love this analogy that he draws, was like, in French, comme un seul narcisse, and I translate it as like a singular narcissus, or one narcissus at once, drawn to photography or the stereoscope, which used photography as well. So I think just the direction that technology and the arts was going in, that that was a great fear of him. I think in some ways maybe it's a little overblown, the hostility, because you look more closely at his longest essay on photography, and he does praise photography in ways. He says it should be used for preservation. You know, the books, you know, archives that could be crumbling, that we could lose, if we can use photography in that way, that would be wonderful. You know, it's so he did see uses for it. And I think the hostility he probably that was probably very much sincere, I think. But at least, you know, the times I read the essay, I said, well, you know, is he getting a little carried away? Is this to attract readers in part? In contrast, and this is where I found, you know, reading Baudelaire with Crow, which I believe hasn't been done too often, or at least not necessarily on the question of photography. Crow also maintained, I'd say, a healthy skepticism, you know, certain pessimism as well, certainly towards the end of his life, about the idea of progress of modern society, high capitalism, technological inventions. But at the same time, he had a certain hope. And one of his origins for developing the technology was his experience teaching deaf students. When he was younger, he taught the deaf. And so one story goes is that he had the idea that, well, maybe we can develop a device that will have a certain amount of spoken phrases in it that the deaf can use to go about their everyday lives. And maybe that can facilitate communication between different cultures, different worlds, even different planets, even interplanetary ideas. So, you know, that was some of the wonder. And, you know, he thought even of, and what if it was really small? He had an idea for, you know, a pocket-sized phonograph, like right after Edison developed his. And it makes me think of, I was listening to a podcast a few months ago, interview with a film director, and the question was put to the director, what do you think about, you know, cameras after they became really small? You had handheld cameras, and what's the historical importance of that? And this director cited, well, you know, two possibilities or two developments that are really important for something that's portable. And this was Crow's vision for these technologies, that they could become more accessible, more portable. And so for film with a handheld camera, you have the political context again, whereas people could film things without necessarily being afraid of, you know, the authorities swooping in. You could film certain events and certain things with something that was handheld that you could sort of hide away. And the other other development that I was totally intrigued by that I never would have thought of was children. You could film children more easily. And it ties back to the story that I write about in the introduction to my book about this great fear of photography in the 19th century, you know, that people were scared of getting in front of a giant machine. You know, what would it do to me? I'm not sure exactly when this happened in the history of cinema and, you know, handheld cameras, but if you had something that was handheld and small, children would act more normally. They would behave, you know, in a way that was more natural, and you could get a vision of life that you wouldn't have otherwise. You know, that's opening up a possibility. It's opening up knowledge. It's maybe not necessarily optimism, but you know, Crow didn't necessarily speak about, you know, portability and, you know, visions of the lives of children or the political context so much in that way. But he certainly did think about, you know, beyond anxiety, he thought about possibilities and what these devices could reveal, how they could contribute to, you know, knowledge, you know, scientific knowledge, but also to the arts.
Right. Yeah. And certainly communicating with, you know, thinking about his work with deaf children, communicating with people that opening channels of communication that otherwise wouldn't exist, right? It's another way of thinking about that. Another thing that strikes me about your book is that it really is, I mean, to sort of historically contextualize it, you make the case in your introduction about the value, maybe even the necessity of studying sound in the 19th century, which kind of in a lot of scholarship, there's been a lot done about visual culture. And certainly there's a lot to be said between painting and you know, impressionism and modern art and architecture and the panopticon and spectacle. I mean, there's been so much done, but you're really looking at the sonic. And I'm wondering, you know, what do you think how do you contextualize your study of sound and acoustic in this particular historical moment? What do you think is happening in the 19th century in Paris, but also in the US, because you're talking about New York, that makes it such an interesting or important time to study sound or to consider sound? And, you know, how is that tied in? It seems to me that it's tied in with kind of the development and the rapid changes in urban space and city life. But I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
Certainly. I guess it's something of an obsession of mine of public transportation. And if I had to, you know, put my finger on an example from the 19th century now off the top of my head, but I write about it in the book, is the omnibus. Development both in Paris and in New York in the 19th century saw massive developments in public transportation with omnibus routes. I can't recall the figures, but suffice to say, it was in the thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who were not really circulating in their neighborhoods, and then were suddenly, you know, seeing other parts of the city, and so this desire to circulate. And at a certain point, I thought about, well, what's the acoustic dimension of that? And you think about as you were mentioning, you know, the visual side of things. In Paris and with Baudelaire, there's this famous glimpse of a woman passing by, one of Baudelaire's famous poems to a woman passing by, une passante. So there's the glimpse, there's the exchange of glances. Friedrich Engels writes about this in terms of people who are suddenly confronted with looking at strangers in the situation of public transit, you know, on something like the omnibus. And what is that anxiety about? What is that experience like to look at other people? And so scholars started to ask, you know, well, what about hearing other people? What about conversations overheard in the street? I was just reading, I come back to some more recent articles, an article in the New York Times yesterday about scientific studies of noise, you know, mostly in urban spaces, you know, things like trains going overhead, and, you know, unfortunately, the damage it can do to our health, sustained shock of noise. And this is something that, you know, scientists are getting more and more interested in now. And this was a question I examined in the book in terms of, you know, that experience of riding the omnibus through the city. A strong point of contrast that I discovered, you know, this was a comparative work between, you know, thinking about Baudelaire and Whitman. Baudelaire has a poem where he describes, I think, you know, women waiting on the side of the street, waiting for the omnibus, and they're trembling with the rolling cacophony of the omnibus, and it's represented as something that is, you know, damaging and certainly a shock in ways. Again, it might be, you know, maybe a little exaggerated, but there was certainly noise in the cities, you know, back then. And Whitman takes a very different perspective on it, and he thought about that noise as a kind of immersive space for him to declaim poetry. And he talked about how he would recite passages from Shakespeare while riding the omnibuses up Broadway in New York. And so for him, it was a kind of, you know, more a model for how big and how varied his poetry could be, his voice could become, his song, the kind of sources for his singing, I think. I think, if I had to pit them against each other in terms of thinking about what was the decibel level, I guess, like, and what they did with those decibels, it was a kind of moment for Baudelaire to think about a kind of damage and something maybe not altogether desired, whereas Whitman thought, look at what I can do with this. I'm going to respond in kind, and I'm going to take it into places people haven't taken it before. So one way you could think of it is a kind of noise as a rival, but noise as a model in a way. what could it do to poetry, and how could it be brought into poetry in a way?
Right. Yeah, no, it's interesting because you mentioned talking about the urban space. It struck me as I was reading your book that these late 19th century texts, you know, were written over 100 years before sound studies as a discipline really emerged in the 60s and 70s. And I'm thinking notably of R. Murray Schafer's work, The Soundscape, where he identifies, you know, that the dangers of urban sound, noise pollution, and these ideas. So I don't know. It makes me think that maybe, and of course today, there's even more to say about these questions. So there's definitely something there, I think, you know, that's linked to sort of the sensorial experience of sound and the sounds of modernity. And it seems like whatever time period it is, these questions are kind of repeating themselves and these around like, are sounds dangerous or unhealthy somehow? How do we grapple with kind of the lives that they have that are beyond our control in some way, or the impact that they have on human life? Seems like they're very much grappling with these questions that are still very of
right,
our time.
Yeah. And I was just thinking yesterday that, you know, for, you know, the origin of soundscape, at least as a term with R. Murray Schafer, was, you know, grappling with the idea of noise pollution. You know, certainly, I mean, I think about sound and soundscapes in other ways, but that was definitely there. And that was something that was on the minds of writers and scientists, artists, you know, in the 19th century. I found an obscure composer, and I write a little bit about him in my introduction, Jean-Georges Casner, and he makes this assertion, you know, pretty startling for the time, that the very noise of a city forms part of its unique character. So he was thinking mostly about music. He was thinking about transcribing and sort of collecting the incidental songs that you would hear from street peddlers, from other sources in the city. But he took a step back, and that's why I thought it was interesting to spend a little time, you know, thinking about him, writing about him, to say, you know, that there is some, he didn't use the term, you know, soundscape, or in French, paysage sonore, but the very noise in a collective general sense. So for him, I felt a bit more the positive side, the aesthetic possibilities of this noise. But he wasn't deaf to the damaging effects as well, to the pollution. And certainly the idea of pollution, you know, light pollution, we have the, there was a important study, Disenchanted Night, you know, thinking about, I think from Wolfgang Schivelbusch, about light technologies in the 19th century and this disenchantment. So disenchantment with noise as well. Certainly that element there in the 19th century, which we might identify a bit more with in 20th century trends. But it was there. It was, you know, there were certainly thoughts about that.
Yeah. And on this question of, you know, noise in the city, and in urban spaces, modern spaces, it seems like this question of the possibility of private listening, kind of how the city is transforming listening practices, how one listens, can one listen alone, you know, anymore. I think the poem that you analyze of Baudelaire's is Les Veuves, and it's about a public kind of concert. So, people that are gathering to listen to music in the park. But also this question of listening in the city space comes up in Poe as well, and kind of his fascination and unnervingness at hearing sounds that he was not intended, of which he was not the intended listener, or the possibility of hearing sounds from interior spaces that are happening, you know, elsewhere, other apartments, other rooms. Anyway, I'm just curious if you could speak a little bit about how these different authors, and I'm sure with Whitman there's other parallels as well, are representing sound to relate notions of space, public versus private, even social class, and what, you know, what is private in or can there be private in the same way in a modern urban setting?
Right. And it's funny that the first thing that comes to mind, I think, is a story that I didn't write about in this book, but might be more of a touchstone for our listeners out there, is Kafka's My Neighbor, a very short, short story, probably from early 1920s, maybe, specifically about the telephone, but really speaking directly to these ideas of privacy, interior and exterior urban space, and just the anxiety that someone is listening on the other side of the wall. And for Kafka, it's with the telephone. There are examples of the telephone in 19th century literature, but I think Poe would certainly be an early exemplar of that kind of anxiety that we see, later with Kafka, with a story like that, with anxieties about what the neighbor could be hearing. The murders in the Rue Morgue, famous story where there are all these witnesses to this, ghastly murder, and they don't know what language they're hearing. Maybe I don't want to spoiler here for people, but I thought that was indicative of how Poe could have taken what was probably at first for a lot of urban dwellers in the 19th century, an unnerving, difficult experience to decipher foreign languages or just different dialects, different accents, suddenly hearing that and hearing it all at once, not being able to make much sense of it. He uses that as a sort of point of departure for this mystery. So it's a sense of all these, these witnesses, ear witnesses, I've heard the term, more so than eyewitnesses. So this is a story of ear witnesses, the murders in the Rue Morgue. So there is like a sense of space being delineated, articulated in different ways through acoustics. Another example that I really like that I write about towards the end of the book in the fifth chapter, when I'm writing about Nina de Villard, she lived at least for a good part of her life in, call it a typical bourgeois apartment building, but was known for these raucous parties, wild, noisy parties, and the most bohemian of salons of the era. And, there was a certain, decorum to, people want their sleep, people want their quiet, existed today, certainly in apartment buildings, but for her, they were committed to this kind of dream of using that space for an artistic salon, for musical salon, and so there's a review of how having an acoustic piano could be awful in that space for the neighbors. Well, the neighbor come back to the neighbors again. I don't know if Kafka wrote about sort of unnerving piano, but this was at least a maddening piano that Nina de Villard had in her apartment. So there's certainly the clash between the bourgeois and the bohemian played out. Acoustic terms in that respect, and that was something I was fascinated to look into when I was doing my research into Villard, how her space was animated acoustically, how that salon sounded, what kinds of ideas we can glean from the written text about it.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you brought her up, because this was a very striking chapter in many ways. It's the only chapter that focuses on a woman. So you're kind of taking apart kind of issues of gender, in this chapter. And your approach was so fascinating because you're showing how important of a figure she was to her time. And, you argue that kind of the soundscape of her salon allows you to recover the sound of the era to some degree, but the way in which you can do that or the challenges with doing that were quite substantial because it took a lot of sleuthing on your part to find these sources. There are no recordings of, any performance of her performances or certainly her salon meetings, and very few records of her composition. Her musical compositions, if I understood correctly. So how did you go about recovering her sonic resonance, if you will? And even in sometimes reading against or reading between the lines of text that were written about her by others.
Right. I did have to read against, in a way, one particular novel that had her, or sort of fictionalized version of her, at its center. This was Catul Mendes's The House of the Old Woman. Old Woman is actually Nina Deviaud's mother. But I think this was probably the most detailed or the lengthiest, I think, account of her life and her salon, but it's, you know, caricaturized, it's caricatural. Can't really take it as, you know, historical testimony, but it does capture something of the spirit of her salon. And I was interested in thinking about it in terms of, like, okay, this is maybe exaggerated, this is mean-spirited in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, she was caricaturized and treated harshly by some of the people that she fed and housed and inspired for years. But I wanted to look at this book thinking about those kinds of questions. What could we still hear? You know, there's, we don't have recordings, you know, maybe there's something out there. I mean, I would love to find it. I doubt it, but you know, did they ever get their hands on an Edison, you know, phonograph? Might they have recorded, you know, a concert, her playing the piano? I mean, I would love to hear that. She was a concert pianist, composer. There may be just a handful of compositions where we have the musical notation that but maybe not even that, just testimony that she composed certain songs, and that's it. So I was looking through a lot of you know, fictional accounts, accounts of contemporaries, certainly visual sources as well. There aren't many photographs either, but Manet has a very famous painting of her, the woman with the fans. I believe it's on display in the Orsay. So to our listeners out there, you've probably seen Nina Deviaud. You've walked through the Musée d'Orsay, but you probably didn't know, you know, she had connections to some of the most important artists and writers that we would think of now from, you know, roughly, you know, 1860 to 1880, her salon was in some ways the place to be. So for me, the challenge was in kind of trying to recover something of that atmosphere, something of the sound of that salon. And I wanted to look, you know, in different sources, not just musical accounts and things. I mean, I could have gone to reviews of her concerts, you know, accounts purely of the musical performances, and I had some of that, but I wanted to think also about fiction, how people were thinking about music, the idea of music and the idea of sound, because it was, you know, beyond a performance space, it was also an intellectual salon where people were really debating ideas, you know, what, you know, where could the science take us as a representation. And I make the claim that she was a real visionary. Something that I'm interested in looking into further is she published a review, I think, of one of the Impressionist shows in the early 1880s, which featured Degas's dancer. I think it was maybe the first showing. And she said that, you know, the public might hate this now, but, you know, I think this is magnificent. This is something that I've dreamed of, actually, is seeing a kind of representation of modern everyday life like this. And ages hence, I think this will be in a museum and will command a kind of respect that it's not getting now. And I believe she might have written about Berthe Morisot, Mary Cassatt as well, in that review. So that's something I want to go and look back at, and her vision as an art critic, but also she was, you know, she and Charles Cros were lovers for nearly 8-9 years. And, you know, people will think of her as a muse, and I think that's important, but to also look beyond that and think about what kinds of ideas, artistic movements were inspired there. What did she inspire as well, and how did she contribute to it?
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating. And it's true that, you know, it takes that extra, like a way of thinking outside the box sometimes to get at that voice, at, you know, voices that are marginalized from traditional source, literary sources and written sources, including women's voices. So I thought it was really interesting how you went about that chapter. And also kind of this thinking about sound, it offers the possibility of thinking about the experience of sound, you know, not just as kind of a theoretical framework, but really kind of a shared, you talk about the community aspect in the salon itself and music, but also how it's linking to other conversations about technology, science, art, how these are all interconnected. It seems like it really comes together well in that final in her salon, in that final chapter.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's ways of listening. That was an ongoing question for me. And for her salon, I made the case it was a kind of informal way of listening, or maybe a particularly bohemian mode of listening that was encouraged and developed there. Sort of, you know, she had her friends who came to the concert hall, the more rigid bourgeois, you know, formal spaces, but also they listened to these songs. They had their own kind of hits in a way, songs that you know were repeated over and over again, sort of that encouraged community, as you say, but also, you know, people were sitting on the floor and, you know, or, you know, reportedly sitting on the floor, you know, and, you know, crouching in the hallway or something, and then, you know, a song would come on. And so that was intriguing to me, you know, how that developed. You know, it was a kind of, to use a, you know, theory from Pierre Bourdieu, kind of habitus, you know, listening habitus, or an informal bohemian habitus of listening there. So I feel like I want to look into that more, but that was something that I was really intrigued by.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And so we're, you know, to kind of, a concluding question perhaps is returning to the beginning. I wanted to ask you about, you know, a little bit about your title, first of all, the Kleidophonic, which is very, you know, a term that you developed, which is really striking and really brings together that audio visual sonic divide that you are breaching in your book. And also, you know, the book's cover image, because we're talking about these, you know, this historical moment of the 19th century, but you're also evoking kind of the possibilities of sound and noise for the future, and how writers of the past were thinking about the future. And on the image of the book's cover, it's basically, for those who haven't seen it, it looks like a room filled with speakers, noise-making devices, with the Italian... Right, yeah. With the Italian philosopher Luigi Russolo and painter Ugo Piatti. And you talk about how Russolo believed that the future belongs to noise. And you quote him by saying, "We must evermore enlarge and enrich the domains of sound." So I'm wondering if you could say a few words about how kind of his thinking about the future of sound, or the sounds of the future, framed your thinking for the book, and why you chose it for the cover.
Yeah, wonderful question. Thank you. Again, strangely, what comes to mind, you know, for an Italian futurist and thinking about the future of sound is what he says about the past, actually. I think he makes the claim, and that I have this in the conclusion, is, you know, ancient life was altogether silent. It was only in the 19th century that noise was born. So he, you know, with the, you know, whatever we think of his, you know, historical claims, you know, he makes the claim that noise, or a certain idea of noise, was born in the 19th century, 19th century cities, you know, to be more precise, and 19th century machinery, industrialization, all of that. And, you know, thinking towards the future, you know, what could be done to harness that as a matter for art, for, you know, beyond music, even thinking beyond, beyond, I think, noise alone. He's thinking about noise sounds. So it's an interesting blend of terminology. You know, we think, you know, kind of cliche of, you know, one person's, you know, music is another person's noise. One person's noise is another person's music. You know, he's thinking in those ways and going beyond them to, like, where can we really blend these sounds or noises into something beyond that could be made for art, you know, Symphony of Noises or something like that. And so I'm happy he's, you know, I don't say a whole lot about him, but he was like, I think an intriguing endpoint of sorts for the book, with that kind of look towards the past and towards the future, you know, what could be done differently with sounds and noises. Also on the cover, as you mentioned, is the Kaleidophonic, and I'm happy. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about that, because it's something that once I had it for the title, I really knew that I wanted that to be the title, but I've been thinking about it a lot, want to keep thinking about it. Appropriately enough, I chose it in part for the sound of it, you know, collide. Finally thinking about collide, the collision of sounds, you know, thinking about, again, going back to Walter Benjamin, the idea of 19th century shock, specifically urban shock, and just the shock of the new, you know, sound is a kind of collision. Collision with the subject, the modern subject in the city. What kind of impact is that? So I'm looking, you know, very often in the book, you know, that kind of collision as the possibility of recording, preserving sound that might make an imprint and leave a trace somewhere. So Kaleidophonic in that sense of, you know, the wordplay, collision of sounds. At the same time, and as I mentioned earlier, was the idea of the acoustic daguerreotype. So the collision of sound and image. One thing I felt I had to negotiate pretty often with this book was the kind of thread a line between anachronism and teleology. I definitely wanted to think about cinema, but I didn't want to have that constantly on the horizon and say, this is, you know, Kaleidophonic is leading towards the cinematic, and this is always proto-cinematic, and wanted to try as best as possible to think about these ideas, discourses, inventions as much in their own terms, in their own moment. But I was very interested in that kind of collision between sound and image. So something like using photography to imagine what sound recording could be like. Acoustic daguerreotype is the idea of what sound recording could be like in the future. Briefly on the Kaleidophone, I still haven't found one. Actually, I'm finding pictures or some designs. I looked through the book again, you know, just this morning to refresh my own memory. It was developed by Charles Wheatstone, an English inventor, in, I think, 1827. Doesn't really look like the kaleidoscope, but the kaleidoscope was the inspiration. But just the description of it is very evocative. It's sort of these rods with silvered beads that had light focused on them. And you would get these very intricate designs depending on, the vibrations of the rods, using different things like a violin bow, and sort of streams of light, that could emerge. So it was actually mostly a visual device, but it had an acoustic side to it. Sort of the sound was the impetus for these designs that could emerge from the device. So for me, that was a point of, more point of departure, sort of conceptually, for thinking about where sound and image impacted. I guess to bring it back to Coe, you know, he spent a lot of time thinking about photography. People might think about him more today for his, you know, almost invention, or, you know, we could give him more than partial, maybe full credit for, you know, inventing sound recording. But he spent so much time working on photography, and the two of them in his writings, both scientific and literary, they intersect. And that was not unique to him. There were other people thinking in terms of, you know, the spectacular, the optical. There were separations, sensory separations, but they did come together. And these intersections were really, you know, some of the things that intrigued me most in writing this book.
Yeah, I think it's really one of, you know, the most important, among the most important contributions of your book, is really challenging us to think, you know, at those intersections as opposed to, you know, dividing them. As you know, disciplines and fields sometimes tend to do. So it was a really fascinating read, and I learned a lot, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for your book, and congratulations on its freshly minted publication. It's the tradition in the podcast to ask about what you're working on next, and it seems like you've evoked a few different possible projects in the works. Is there anything you're working on currently that you want to share anything about with listeners?
Sure. I do want to spend some more time with both Charles Cros and Nina de Villard. I've got some articles in the works. Another one on Cros' collaborations with Edouard Manet. They were close friends for, I feel like, roughly 8 years. There's a little correspondence, not a lot, but they did collaborate on a book as well as some photography experiments. So I'm really curious about, you know, continuing that kind of line of investigation. At the same time, I'm interested in maybe a little relief from footnotes, and maybe a novel or a novella could be. I don't know, something involving Balzac. I don't know if I'm going to give any more detail beyond that, but something involving Balzac and no footnotes might be a little nice interlude. We'll see what happens. Stay tuned.
Oh, well, I certainly will. That sounds refreshing, and I'm very intrigued. So I look forward to hearing more about it. Maybe next time. But yeah. But anyway, thank you again, Brett, so much. It was really a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks for joining me on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.